You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to my guest, Holly Bott. Holly's story is dramatic. And to be really upfront and honest, there are parts of this interview and Holly's story that many of you are going to find fairly disagreeable. And the intro to this episode on the audio podcast and the YouTube video is a little longer than usual because I'm giving you time to choose something else if you want. In this conversation, we talk about prison because Holly was incarcerated for committing a sex crime. And I want to acknowledge that upfront and just put it right out there that for a lot of people, this is a very unpleasant idea. The only guest on the show is Holly. And so because there are other people involved in this story, I also want to acknowledge that there are other sides to the story and other people involved. And so by its very nature of the format of the show, this is an incomplete telling of this story, but it's Holly's story. Sex crimes are actually right now top headlines in the news in the United States because of the Epstein files. I'm recording this at the end-ish of November. Hopefully those will be out of the news cycle by the time this drops and releases in January. I'm giving you this heads up about the content because I want to give you the option to make the best decision for yourself, whether or not this is an episode that you want to consume. I'm even going to mark the episode as explicit on the audio platforms, which is something that I haven't done yet in the show. This is the second time I've recorded this intro. I thought about it overnight. And one of the things I considered actually was just not releasing it and not having to deal with any of the pushback or feedback that I might get for having this type of content on the show. It is the reality that what happens is that when I put these stories out, the impact is that I am amplifying and magnifying the reach. That's what it does. This is a small show, but it does have reach, and the reach grows daily. I decided to release the story, and I'll tell you why. I interview a wide variety of guests, and I share their experiences as humans, and their experiences are very different than mine. So the reality that somebody's a guest on the show doesn't actually mean that I have alignment with their ideas or their actions or that we are affiliated in any way. But no matter how clearly I state that and how much people might know that, the other side of that is that there are definitely people in the audience who are going to judge me, judge the show, judge the platform based on the people I have as guests. That's just the way it goes. That's just the reality of the situation. As a person, I do my best to tell each story with dignity and professionalism, treating the guest as a human being, as a person. As the producer of this show, I actually think that the audience, that you in the audience, are smart enough to make your own decisions about what you think about the content, about what you think about me, about the guest, and the show. And so I've made an editorial decision with several of these episodes just to allow you that decision. You get to decide. So when we hear stories of people who do things that we don't agree with, I think it's normal to ask ourselves, how could anybody do that? But I also think that the other side of that is that most of us are living one small decision, one small action away from a radical change in our lives. That's actually kind of one of the themes of the show, right? I only know a little tiny bit about my guests when we start the interview. I don't have a fact-checking department. I'm not the New Yorker magazine. Nope. I did know that Holly had been in prison, but I actually didn't know for what crime until I asked her during the interview. My journalism professors way back in the 1900s, they would probably score me poorly on that, to be upfront. Holly openly shares the details of her crime, and we talk about the choices that she made that eventually got her into prison. She shares the impact of her life as a felon from her first person perspective. She talks about the stigma she feels that she's experienced after being charged before going to prison, while she was in prison as a part of that community, and now after she is released into what we'd call society. And she has made the decision to go public with her story. This is her story, and she's decided to be public about it. And so I've decided I'm going to respect that. A part of Holly's story is faith-based, and she is a Christian. This is not a faith-based show, but we do talk about that during the interview because it is part of Holly's story. Jeepers, I had a lot to say about this. Almost definitely, I am making a mountain out of a molehill, but let's go with it. Are you ready for the interview? All right, here we go. Welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. Holly Bott, are you ready for a fun conversation?
I absolutely am.
Yay. All right. Yeah. First question. What part of the world do you call home?
I am in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Love it. Love it. All right. So next warm-up question. So we're recording this like sort of right before Thanksgiving. It's not going to come out until January, but this has a Thanksgiving theme to it. I have leftovers already on my mind. So the question is, do you like leftovers? And if you do, do you have a leftover that you will eat cold out of the fridge without warming it up?
So I didn't like leftovers until the air fryer became a thing. And an air fryer can make it taste like it was just made. So yes, but I don't have a favorite. I think maybe pizza. Pizza in the air fryer.
Cold pizza. That's one of the things I had. It's one of the things I had in my mind because it's, yeah, I don't know. Some people are super creeped out by leftovers. The kids in my house, they just think that everything is only meant to be eaten fresh. But I'm a big fan. All right. So today's conversation, to be honest with the audience, I'll be really upfront. It has a pretty dramatic start. If I do say so myself, that's a little bit of the warning for people's ears to perk up and pay attention. We're going to talk about how your life changed because of serving a prison sentence, incarceration. So are you ready to talk about that with me?
I am. Thank you.
All right. You got it, Holly. Let's do it. So you shared with me that you, I think you were sentenced to 12 years and served 8. Is that
correct?
The math? Okay.
That's
all right. So can we start with what got you in there? I'm not sure exactly what the right words for this question are because my only training for this is watching things like Law and Order, which is not actually training at all. But so what what is the lead up to how you ended up being sentenced to 12 years in prison?
So I suppose there's a lot of ways people could answer that. For me, the short answer is my charges were, I was 34 years old and I had 5 children. My oldest was in high school and I had sex with one of his high school friends.
Oh, and, that is even juicier than I expected. Okay, go on.
And so I was arrested for that. And I just wanted to plead guilty, I knew that I was facing something serious, but I didn't want to fight this in court or anything. And it takes about a year to work through the court systems. They don't show that on Law and Order, that's for sure. And it's just a lot of pencil pushing. And so it took about a year for me to receive my sentence. And the sentence was 12 years in prison. And at that time, my children were 16, 11, 10, 8, and 4 years old. And so it was a very devastating sentence. There's great leeway. I don't know what it is in other places, but in the state of Minnesota, the judge has the ability to give just probation or a maximum of 12 years. And so walking into the courtroom facing my sentencing, I did not know what to expect. And there really weren't any hints. And I hoped that I would walk home that day on probation. And I almost passed out when he said 12 years. Really, my blood pressure dropped, my vision went dark, and I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. So that's kind of what led up to me finding myself in cuffs.
Yeah, no, I think that I think it's actually it's very true that they don't show that part on TV, how slow the process is. I had just sort of read about it in a variety of, you know, things. The Orange is the New Black, in that book, they talk about that in there, how long it takes. And so that was definitely one of the things that I was curious about. So it was a year between when you were arrested and charged with a crime and when you had your day, your sentencing day in court. And then if I'm understanding correctly, all that was happening in between is you accepted, you pled guilty.
Yes.
You accepted the charge.
I was out on bail.
Okay.
And awaiting sentencing. And I will tell you, it's such a state of shock. Any crime not only traumatizes the victims in the community, but the person themselves is traumatized, the perpetrator. We traumatize ourselves by what we didn't believe we were capable of. And so that sort of, it's an identity crisis, and it's the beginning of many, because prison will cause more identity crises. And I did not help myself at all that year waiting up to sentencing. I almost wanted to just hide and have the system do with me what it will.
Yeah.
And I didn't research anything. I didn't hire a lawyer. It's almost like I wanted to punish myself as much as I wanted them to punish me. So that's very
That's okay.
common.
No, I think that so it sounds to me as an outsider, but just knowing my own personality when I know that something's going on, or even the kids that have been in my family, and they know they've broken a rule. They know, but they know that they hope that there's a chance that somebody will wave the magic wand and it's going to go away. And there was a chance that the judge would have done this in that case. So I think it leans a little bit into human nature to say, well, there's a chance that I might not get this. Okay, so you were, I think at the time this happened, you were 36, is what you shared with me.
The sentencing is when I was 36. I committed the crime just before my 35th birthday, and I
At
was sentenced
34.
a month after my 36th birthday. So,
All
a year
right.
and 2 months worth of time in there, yeah.
Oh my goodness. That's a long time. And so you were out on bail. All right. So let's talk a little bit about what life was like before all this happened. You share that you came from a middle class background, and you say that you never knew anybody who even had a criminal record, which I gotta tell you, I think that's very impressive, because I think by my mid-30s, I did know plenty of people who had their own run-ins. Maybe that says more about my friend group than anything else. I don't know. But let's talk about what did life look like for you before this? You had five kids, living in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis. Do you have family? Were you married? What was going on? Were you working? Tell me all the things.
Yep. So I was working. I was a work at home mom, work at home
Okay.
stay mom. And I was doing computer programming, which you can do remotely. So that was great, even back then.
Okay.
And it was my second marriage. It was not going well. I was married one time before at age 18, just a really impulsive act, out of fresh graduated from high school. Me and a man I had dated in high school ran off to Vegas and got married, came back, went for the weekend, got married, came back. It was a I don't fully understand all the reasons that I did that, except for probably attention seeking. And life was so scary out of my parents' house and living on my own. I was looking for a helper, and I don't know. But anyways, we had one child together, and the marriage lasted less than a year. And he didn't provide any child support. He was not helpful at all when he moved out. And so in an effort to provide for myself, I got a job driving semi trucks.
Oh, goodness, that's exciting. I've always thought that would be fun.
It was, and it paid the best for someone my age, without a college degree. It was
Okay.
a Teamster union job, great health insurance. However, it's physically demanding because part of my job was loading and unloading these semis. And so by age 23, I was really worn out. Working graveyard shift, taking care of my son during the day. I mean, there were some weeks I got 10 hours of sleep for the whole week, just like 2 hours a night. That's it. And so I started thinking, I really need a partner again. And I went looking back to the same dating pool I had looked at the last time, and I reconnected with someone I had known in high school, and we got married. Now, it's not that I didn't like him or love him, but I really think I was hearkening back to a time before things went wrong, looking for a restart and a partner. So we were married and had four more children for a total of five. But my happiness was very situational.
Okay.
And so I began to suffer great depression. In my family, as you mentioned, I grew up in a traditional home. Divorce was frowned on, especially in the 80s and 90s. No one growing up that I was around smoked or drank or cursed, nothing, very sheltered childhood. And so when I became divorced at age 19, I was the person people talked about behind my back, and I was the black sheep, the shameful person. And so now, as I'm married this second time and things aren't working, I don't know who to turn to for help. Everybody's marriage seems perfect to me. Mine's not. What do I do? I started taking medications for depression and anger and mood stabilizers, a whole package,
Okay,
antipsychotics,
yeah.
everything. And
So you
I
were really struggling at this point.
really struggling, and I really wanted to divorce my second husband by the time I was in my 30s. But a couple of things held me back. I didn't want that shame again. I was really trying hard to project this image that I had overcome these past hurdles. I have a nice house now. I have these lovely children. They're in private school. I'm working from home. I'm successful in this job. And it was all largely a sham. And so I really reached a crisis moment of desperate measures, right? So me committing my crime, like many crimes I've interviewed other women and men, it's almost like this is a problem-solving measure, this crisis decision, whether you're removing yourself from society or who knows what, but it's always poor reasoning from a lack of transparency and asking others for help until you finally just feel desperate.
So there's a lot there. There's definitely a lot there. So your family of origin you describe as sheltered, and you say that you were really searching for a partner to be a life partner and help you do the work that you needed to do as an adult. There's actually research about that. There was a book that came out in the 80s, which I'm spacing. The author, I think, is Barbara Hetherington, and it's based on what they call the Virginia Longitudinal Study of Marriage and Divorce. And they look at remarriages, and a huge number of the remarriages are very functional. It's like people hit the point where they're like, "This is a lot of work by ourselves, and it's very expensive," and so they recouple very quickly to sort of share the labor. And so I don't think you're alone in that, in making a decision for that, because anybody who's, I mean, you've got five kids, you're running a house. That is an enormous amount of work that anybody, I mean, you had one kid when you remarried, but kids are a huge amount of work, and having more kids are wonderful and lots of love, but kids don't make anything easier. They
No.
don't, when you add kids, it doesn't make less work. And so there you go. All right. So one of the things you said, and I want to talk about it, if we can, is that what you were doing is looking back on this is that you were confused about the choices that you made. And I guess it sounds like not just the choices that got you arrested, but also the choices in choosing these partners is one of the things that you were confused about. So I love to talk to people about the choices they make because of exactly what you said. It's very interesting. What are the things that are going on? Because I tend to think that we almost always make the choice that feels right in the moment. This is the best choice that's right in front of me. From an outsider, from a different perspective, sometimes you look back and say, "Wow, no, that was, there were other options." But in the moment, like that's that. So, what was confusing about these choices to you at the time? Like, what was confusing? What was going on? And if this is too personal, just tell me to buzz off. But walk me through making the choice that eventually got you arrested, like to be involved with somebody that was a high school student.
I recently watched a Dateline episode, I hope that's okay to say.
Sure.
But it was a rerun, and it was a woman had been a prison guard. She was in her 40s, married with kids, and she helped an inmate who had life without parole to escape. And so this was an episode that had happened many years in the past, and now she's on there sharing. When she shared her motivations for what she did and what was going on, that was the first time I had ever heard someone else say what I'm about to tell you. I felt like she was telling my story. And it's the first time I learned that maybe this is sort of a phenomenon. We just don't talk about it very much, which is, I'm so glad that she did. And it's a reason I'm willing to, because I don't want anybody else to walk this road. And so for me, I felt baffled because my parents really projected the confidence that they had raised smart, good children in a perfect manner. So if we don't turn out perfect, what's going on? What went wrong? Did I not listen to them? Was I not sincere enough in wanting to be a good daughter? And I really wanted to be a good girl. And so then, how am I making these choices that so upset my parents? What's wrong with me? Now, when it came to the decision to commit a crime, to have sex with an underage high schooler, by that point, several things were going through my head that had been kind of brewing for maybe a year or two. My husband and I had separate bedrooms at this point. We were barely on speaking terms. And I began to quite resent him. At first, when we were married, I didn't have an actual job working from home. I sold on eBay and I tried a number of things to bring money in, but he was the breadwinner. And we were so poor. Our utilities were shut off often. I was very thin because I gave the food to the kids and to him. Not to say I made wise financial choices because we also smoked and drank a lot of soda pop. So, but the reality was that times were tough. So when I was hired as a computer programmer and began to work from home, I quickly began to out-earn him. My income became double his easily. So I became prideful and disrespectful to him. And I began to feel frustrated with him that if I'm making twice as much as you, why do I also do all the homework or the housework and driving the kids around and stuff? So this resentment really grew till it was hate.
As it
And
does.
I wanted validation and affirmation for all these hard things I saw myself doing. And so, in an attempt to receive that, I began to try to make the whole world hate him in comparison to me as much as I hated him. What this requires is that I be a superwoman because the contrast between me and him has to be really extreme to be noticeable from the outside. So, I'm becoming a workaholic. I am, doing more housework than I ever did before. I mean, you name it, I was burning myself out at both ends of the candle. That is not sustainable at all. And it doesn't accomplish what you wish. And so after a year of this, and my depression is just getting worse, I began to think maybe I should get divorced and just end all of this. So that's when you start planning a And now I'm thinking, well, my parents might make me go back to him. I mean, I'm in my 30s. They're not going to make me do anything, but this is what I'm thinking is I'll be so shamed. I'll go back and so let's not even go down that route. I can barely handle what I'm doing now. I can't handle extra emotional pressure. And suicidal thoughts began to enter my head. What if I just wasn't here? And so now my son has this friend who's coming over to the house and everything, and he wants to talk to me. Finally, I have someone who wants to listen to my stories. And so it was really just I'm lonely and looking for a friend, and this is an available friend. So that was the beginning of, and actually all of my interest in this was very selfishly, I just wanted someone to talk to or someone who noticed me, recognized what I was doing.
So let me ask a question about that, because I think that for a lot of people who probably come across your story, and I'm not I, you've gone on and written a book, so I'm not the first person that I think you've talked to about this, and you've done a lot of work on yourself. But so you were working from home, you have five kids in the house, you're unhappy and lonely within the adult relationship inside this house. Did you have like a friend group outside of the marriage, or what were you isolated? Like, I mean, what was your did you have community and other adult friends, or how cut off were you from like a support network or any of those things when this was going on?
Great question. I did not have a solid support network of friends. I did have a best friend. She's a cousin of mine, and she had seven kids. And so I really felt I could relate in many ways to her, and she is a very helpful person to me. But of course, she's very busy with her own things. And working from home and taking care of the kids from home meant I just didn't have a lot of available time to socialize. And I did not take advantage of opportunities like going to church to have where we all go together and there's a woman's group there or something. I was not taking advantage of things that were available to me. And so, no. I mean, my family was around. I would not say that they were truly aware. And part of this was my fault. I was not being transparent. Was intentionally projecting the image that everything is fine.
And that was being driven partly because of your awareness and sensation that your actions reflected on your parents,
Correct.
and that was important to you. I want to just quickly touch on the fact, because I think this is the unspoken question that the audience has bouncing around in their head. And so I'll ask you, and you can tell me as much or as little as you want about it. What were you aware? And or was there any time where you were like, this is not appropriate behavior, and I should not do this?
Yes, absolutely. After even just so this kid's over, and sometimes he's stopping by my office and at the home at my computer desk just to say hey and what's going on and whatever. There was, I don't know how even to explain. He started to stop by more and more, and I don't want to say too much about this kid. Well, he's in his
Right,
30s
because we
now,
want to
but
be, yeah, but we do want to be sensitive about
yep.
the fact that we're telling your story and not
Yep,
his. Yeah,
that
100%.
he came from a difficult home life. So I think he was interested in a happy home life or whatever we were presenting at our house. And that he was attracted to that. And so he started stopping by more and more. And I started to get the then I started to feel uncomfortable. My kids don't stop by my computer when I'm working this much to talk to me. Something's a little off. But again, I thought, what's the harm? Right? But the harm was that things were growing, that if you don't nip in the bud when you first have those red flags, even minor ones, you should stop and ask yourself some questions. I really did use the tool of problem solving of ignore it and it will go away. It'll just work itself out. And it never does. So, finally,
And none of your friends, so your cousin who was your best friend and your family, you did not talk to them about, did you talk to them about this relationship? I should not assume.
No.
And so, okay. So you're aware that this is, you're aware of the line, you proceed anyway. I think that I will just say this. I think that because you've faced a lot of stigma and a lot of judgment, and you've served your time for this. And so I want to just say that I think that humans are very much motivated by finding people who see them, who hear them. That force of like being loved and feeling loved is a really, really strong pull. And I think, I'm not an expert. I'm not talking about something I know, but I mean, there are millions of stories and books of people doing extreme things, both good, bad, and all the thing, just because they're chasing that sensation. And so for the people who are listening, there's so many times in the adult experience where you hear something that happened to somebody else and you think, I don't think I would ever do that. And that might be true, but I think that the flip side of that is none of us know what we're going to do in any particular situation until we actually walk it ourself. And so through that lens, for the anybody's listening, watching,
For me, I will say that the real serious line, the line of which it's there's no going back from this, and this will become a crime if I take this next step. What went through my mind was this would be social suicide. And if I am too cowardly to kill myself for
From real
real,
life.
this is a way that everyone will give up on me. The pressure, it was unrealistic, totally irrational thinking, but I was thinking this is a way that everyone will just say, oh, forget about her, and I can stop performing.
So that's really interesting because there is a thing about burnout and women, and specifically parents, people who are in that job, where they talk to women who fantasize about becoming very, very sick. Specifically, they have a fantasy of being put in the hospital, right? When you think to yourself, who would have the fantasy of doing that? They're so tired that the only way they can see of getting out from underneath all the work is that they would be in the hospital. And so what I hear you saying is that when you think back at this, you were willing to burn everything down. And you were aware of that, and that was that. It's a little bit of a mismatch, though, from that and then the sentencing and hoping that somebody would make it go away. Okay.
You know, when I was in jail and I was arrested, you know, when I was 35, just after my 35th birthday, and had to be bailed out. And while I was waiting to be bailed out, another inmate came over and said something like, I'm getting out of here soon. I bet you're hoping to get out of here soon. And I looked at her and said, I'm not ready to go home.
Yeah.
And I meant it. And she looked at me like I was the strangest person she had ever met. Who wants to be here? And I was thinking, me.
Because it was away from your problems. All right. So you served 8 years, you were sentenced to 12, just because I'm a super curious, annoying person. What was the level of prison that you were in? So you at first you were in jail, then you get out on bond, you're on bail, you're home, and then you go to prison. What level of security prison were you in?
So in Minnesota, there's only one
Oh,
women's
okay.
state prison, and it is all custody levels from minimum all the way up to supermax. What's really interesting is when I was incarcerated there, there was no fence. You could just
Oh.
literally walk off the property, and we wore street clothes. And so, and there are women there sentenced to life without parole that have been there 20, 30 years, and they just don't leave. And so it was very surreal for me when I arrived there. It looks exactly like a college campus. We're not all indoors. You know, the cafeteria is one building. You walk, you know, 100 yards to get to, you know, the work building or to your living unit. And there was many times that you're allowed from building to building by yourself without a supervising guard, even in the dark. Right. If someone came to visit me and it was evening and it's dark out, they would let me out of my living unit. I would walk across the property by myself on this unfenced prison area over to the visiting room. And then sometimes I even had to knock on the door, like, hey, because the guard in the visiting building would not be paying attention. And I'd be
Okay.
locked. Essentially locked out of the prison and would, hey, let me in. I have a visit. And so very bizarre, but they really had almost no escapes in all the history. I remember just before I got there's a woman who escaped to go to a concert, and then she came back after the concert.
Oh my goodness. Well, I mean, if you're not that well, listen, there you go. Okay, so all right. So then this sounds to me like, I mean, 12 years, 8 years, this sounds to me like an enormous amount of time. And I want to ask you, because you say that during this time you found humility and love for others. Can you tell me more about what you mean by that? Like, what was it about the incarceration experience that leaned into humility and love for others?
Well, I was not humble when I entered, and I've kind of alluded to that in explaining my efforts to look like Superwoman and that I was very disrespectful to my husband and things. And since I'd grown up sheltered and didn't know anybody who had a felony background, then I felt self-righteous or superior, right? So that also led to the confusion of how could I have committed a crime? How could I be here? This defies who I think of as Holly. And something interesting that happens when someone is convicted and sentenced for a crime, especially a serious crime, the general public immediately makes a new label for that person. And in the public's mind, it's an immediate identity switch. However, as the person who committed the crime, we don't do that. We don't relabel ourselves. We can't help but see the person we've been since we ever made a memory. And so then that's baffling. Am I this monster? And everything. So that was the pride aspect, really, is not, at first, not digging deep into those questions, and then just allowing myself to be confused because I didn't want to ask myself the hard questions. Therefore, there's no answers, and I'm just confused. And then love for others. I was still bitter and angry and resentful at my ex-husband, not because of my crime, but just for the same reasons I had been before I committed a crime. I was upset with my family for not noticing I had been in crisis mode. And just so this left me not a very loving person.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be in this prison. So I don't want to love anybody around me either. I just want to be out of here. And it wasn't the prison that changed me. And, I talk about this in my book, and, we can talk about this later or not at all, but it really was when faith, well, I will just say when Jesus gave me a desire to read the Bible, and I had no interest when I entered prison of finding God, seeking God, reading the Bible, none of that stuff, at zero interest. And I never developed on my own an interest. In fact, I was quite put off. I thought of myself as a good Christian culturally, socially, but I had no interest in fanaticism or actually reading any of that or talking about it or anything. And about 5 years into my stay, that changed, not because I was doing anything different. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know what good terms would be, but I had a bizarre experience where all of a sudden the Bible was the most interesting book I had ever read, and I could not put it down. And I read it and read it and read it and read it and read it, and I could not figure out, why on earth am I wanting to read this book? Because I tried to read it in the past. It was boring. I didn't like it. So why do I like it now? It was weird. But that was the start of things changing for me because there's good advice in it about, not being prideful and loving others. And I began to think, I thought I was such a good person, but well, first my thought was, I wonder who all these prideful people are that the Bible is talking about. Certainly not me. But I began to recognize that it was me.
Okay.
And so then I thought, maybe I really do need to change. And that's when the change began, is at that point, for that reason.
So it sounds like the faith journey, one of the way it turned into this self, it gave you an opportunity to do some self-examination and reflection, and it gave you a framework of examples, and I think we would call them virtues, like the characteristics to inspect. So you're upfront about this. It's a big part of your book, The Faith. Was religion and faith a part of your life growing up? And what did that look like? So you
It
said you
did.
considered yourself a good Christian, but it also you said you weren't going to church group. So what role was religion playing in your life growing up and before all this stuff happened?
Well, my parents brought me and my brother to church every Sunday and for youth groups and things. And then they sent us both to a private Christian school.
Okay.
I went there
So you
through.
knew the rules.
I did. I knew the rules. And I really embraced all of this. But I think some of the reason I was embracing it was snobbery, right?
Okay.
I'm at this private school, and if I can follow the rules perfectly, that will be proof that I'm a good person that I can point to and whatever. So, as I got to be an adult, and that didn't pan out, receiving the affirmation and the validation that I was using it as a tool for, then I just kind of fell away. What's the point? But anytime I started to feel bad or life went a little wrong, then we'd all go back to church for a Sunday or two, but it just didn't stick because, again,
Okay.
it wasn't solving problems.
And so, but you would have identified yourself as a Christian all the way through this. You Christened or baptized the kids. Yeah. Okay. So, and then, all right. So it's a part of your book. I ask, I'm going to bring this today. You know, religion is one of those topics. People are like, ah, oh, should we talk about it? Should we not talk about it? Where does it go? You know, there are people who like it. Life was better when we didn't talk about politics with people we didn't know and religion. But, so this might feel a little tiny bit like a weird question, but I like to bring these things sort of front and center so that the audience gets the full perspective because it is religion and faith and Christian faith is a part of your book. And so, would you say that people who are in the audience and listening to this or watching it, you know, and if they're not Christian, if they're people who do not believe in God, does that make them a good reader of your book? Does it cut them off from understanding your story? How would you talk about that?
Great question. And I wondered that myself. The book talks about me, and it's not telling people what to do. It's simply explaining my own experiences. But I wondered how it would be perceived. And so the book launches next month. And in advance of the book release, I've been having advanced readers receive a
Sure.
free copy, read it, and then provide feedback. And there was a complete stranger to me. She's in Australia. And never met her, but she signed up on Facebook to read this advanced copy. She read it and then she went and posted reviews everywhere that were so glowing about how the book forced her. She's not a Christian or not religious at all that I'm aware. The book forced her to confront attitudes that she was using to justify poor behavior and really held a mirror to herself, and she appreciated it. And she added the caveat in her reviews that despite the religious aspects, my book did not seem preachy or sermonizing at all, that I was simply using the Bible or Bible verses at sometimes for a pivotal moment in my life to explain why that happened and why I thought what I thought. But otherwise, she didn't feel it was overhanded or anything like that. And she recommended that anybody who's having a hard time, it could be a valuable tool. And I thought, that's great feedback. I'm really glad she said that because I do want it to help everybody for so many reasons.
Yeah, no, I can. So I appreciate you taking the time to answer that because it does sometimes put people into a kind of well, I don't know how to answer this sort of situation. But I think where we have the overlap because the audience of the show is very diverse, and so we have no idea, you know, who's listening and what their experience is. And no one likes to buy a book and then or get halfway into a story and then be like, oh, I don't understand this, or it's not really for me for any variety of reasons and so on. So there we go. All right, so let's talk about stigma and the because I am gonna guess that this was a very public event in your town. Like there was probably news and you were in the spotlight, I think, of your community, I would guess. All right. So anybody who goes to prison, they face the stigma of being judged for their alleged crimes and then what they're convicted of, with the notable exception maybe of Martha Stewart. Okay. So let's talk about the impact of this. This is a character offense. You were a parent. Did this restructure your relationship with your spouse and your kids? Like, did you lose like access to your kids for a while or anything like that? No. Okay, so there was no just prison.
No, it was just
Yeah.
prison. My husband, now ex-husband, was very
Ex-husband.
angry with me. And
Yeah.
so,
I think you could probably understand that.
correct. Yes, absolutely. And he became the caregiver for the four children I had with him.
Okay.
My oldest son, right, who was 16 when I went to prison, chose to live with my parents, and he
Okay.
did until he graduated. My ex-husband moved from Minnesota to Seattle, Washington, where his family lived, and he brought our four children with him.
Okay.
And so my only access to them was through him. And I remember it, one time I called his phone because they're too young to each have their own cell phones. And again, this is, 16 years ago. So that wasn't a thing then anyways, really. I called him and he said, "Do you know why I answered the phone for you?" And I really didn't because I was paying for the calls. So it
Yeah.
wasn't money that would prevent him. Why is he answering? And he said, "Our boys, which were older, they love you," he said, "and they would be mad if I didn't answer the phone for you. And that's why I do." He said, however, our daughter, who was 4 when I went into prison, he said, I'm going to try to make her forget you, that you ever existed, if I can. And if I can't do that, I will make her hate you as much as I do. And he was really, I think he was really quite serious. And so that was the disconnect, but it wasn't legal, a legal separation or anything like that. So that was awful.
Okay, so he moved. He moved to a different state. You go into prison in Minnesota. What other kind of stigma, like how did it show up? In my mind, I can just see this being like you might have been on television, it was in the newspaper, people who knew you knew what had happened to you. What was that like?
Yes,
It seems
those
like it
things
was
did
your
happen.
worst nightmare, seeing as you were very concerned about your
Yes.
behavior reflecting on your parents, and then it went public. So yeah,
Yes.
let's talk about the stigma. There you go.
I created my most worst nightmare and then was forced to live it out. The stigma w wasn't too much when I was out on bail because I hid mostly at home. I don't want to be in public. When you go to prison, though, all the inmates want to look you up. Right. And the inmates are no different from the general public. They all have their opinions of who's good, who's bad, and labeling people. And I would say that if prison culture has a hierarchy, that sex offenders fall at the bottom of the list. Now, at the prison I was at, there was maybe 700 inmates, and only maybe 10 of us had a sex crime. And now in Minnesota, prostitution is considered a sex offense. Being a sex or a human trafficker is a sex offense. Being a madame or a female pimp is a sex offense. So I'm not saying these were all women who committed the same crime as me. Some of them were just prostitutes and stuff, but there's only 10 of us, very small portion. In the men's prisons, it's like 25% of the entire population. And again, it's not just crimes like mine. You could urinate in public and now you're convicted of a sex offense, but it's higher for men. And so I don't know if that made us more of a target because there are so few of us, or if it made us almost invisible. But when I was there, the few women that I did meet that I knew what their charges were, that it was a sex case, they hid in their room. They didn't want anybody to know why they were there and what had happened. And I thought, I can't live like that because I have caused harm and I want to stop hiding from people's honest response of anger and disgust. They have a right to feel those things. I don't want to invalidate it. Not that I should be beat up for this, but at least it would help me to recognize and emotionally understand the damage that I've done, right? And if I hide from that, I'm cheating myself, I'm cheating community. So I did not publicize why I was there, but I was truthful if I was asked. And I experienced much less bullying or harm than I anticipated. There were a few incidences where people were unkind, but for the most part, prison is so hard, it's difficult to find the energy to bully someone else or worry what they're doing. When I was released from prison, I would say the stigma there maybe happens. It's an everyday part of a person's life, but it doesn't happen every day. I think that any prison sentence is a life sentence, even if you only served a year on the facility, because you are a felon forever. It's in your background checks for housing, for employment. If you're going to date someone new and marry them, hopefully you're disclosing that. And so it follows you forever. And so that's always in the back of your mind. And I want to be sensitive to the people that I meet, whether or not they need to know this, if it doesn't matter, would knowing hurt them or help them? And just be really careful on how I approach the subject, not for my sake, right? Not that I want to invite, right, stigma and unkind treatment, but for other people's sake, I'm kind of used to it by now. So the stigma is, it's real. It's real.
Yeah, and it's by design that of the jailing system in our country that it is supposed to follow you forever. Are you part of the sex offender registry based on the type of crime?
Yes. So I have to register for 10 years after leaving prison. Next month, it'll be 7 years since I left. So I have 3 more years of registering.
So it affects where you can live,
Well,
jobs.
for me,
Yeah.
it doesn't affect where I can live
Okay.
or necessarily jobs. There are levels of
Okay.
sex offender. I guess they'd call it like danger levels, and mine
Okay.
is the lowest level. So really, I need a probation officer's approval for things, but I don't have to ask approval for everything, and there's nothing that's outright a no. It's discretionary.
Okay, that's very interesting. I didn't know that. Because people are, the data is, depending on where you live, the data is, can be very, very public, and people use, the app, next door app, to figure out who their neighbors are and who lives there. And sometimes, sometimes I can imagine that this would come sneaking up, even though you're not trying to hide who you are, but I can imagine that you would be confronted by somebody who would challenge you, based on they discovered that you were a felon.
I don't think that's ever happened. But again, I am so interested in helping other people, and even if the person I'm speaking to isn't the person who might have a problem, they might be worried about someone else who does. And so again, I don't
Okay.
advertise my felony status, but it's in my everyday life. I do prison ministry now. So I will talk about I'm visiting my friend that I did time with in prison, and then that sparks a conversation. But that's just I'm not trying to hide those things. They just and one of the jobs that I've had since leaving prison is I was the general manager and ran a very large multi-million dollar company. The person who hired me and put me in charge, of course, he's been a friend since high school, so, and he's been very supportive this whole time. But he received a lot of flack. Is that the right word?
Or
Pushback.
resistance, pushback, sure. Yeah.
Or even just criticism
Yeah.
for making a decision. How can you put a felon in charge of your whole business and everything else? And I am so grateful to him because he has a partner in the business as their co-owners, and their families got together first before they even offered me a job. What can we expect? Can the business handle if this is very public and people are really resistant? And they desired to hire me anyways and came to me with that and offered me the job. And their commitment was so strong that when they did receive pushback, they didn't even tell me.
Yeah,
They
that's
did
very
not,
interesting.
yeah, they didn't let me hit the brunt of it. So very wonderful.
And this is, again, it's not my expertise, but there are a couple of very public stories of people who've come out of incarcerated systems and then gone on, and they talk about it. One of them is the most recent book, The Secret Life of Mama Love, is her story of working after being in prison. The founder of, I think, Dave's Bread, Dave's Super Bread, or something like that, he talks about it. He went into business because he was not able to find a job to be hired because of his resume, his felonisms on his resume. So it's definitely something that others have talked about. Do you worry at all based on the stigma of when you release the book and more people find out about your past? Do you worry about more visibility and it coming back to get sort of bad juju coming your way?
You know, I don't worry about it. I certainly expect it.
Okay.
But I have already received a lot of wonderful feedback from like family members of incarcerated individuals who were so concerned about them, and they just really needed encouragement and hope. And so I think it's worth it. And I'll tell you, the reason I wrote the book was I was writing to my former self. This is the book I wish I had had before I committed my crime, or the day I entered prison, or you name it. At some time in the past when I was broken and discouraged and thought there was no hope and that I was the black sheep forever, if I had had this book, it would have mitigated a lot of the impact to myself and to my family, to my children, to my community, because I would have, from the start, perhaps acted and behaved a little differently. Having hope. I might have started to work on myself sooner, believing it was worthwhile, that I wasn't a throwaway person. And if my family had had a book like this, perhaps they did give up on me. I did get my wish of social suicide. And that was hurtful to them, not helpful to them to give up on me. And maybe this book would have eased their burden sooner as well. And so that's the book that I wrote. I just wrote it speaking to my old self. And I do hope that it will find someone else in that circumstance and help them.
All right, so one more question, then we'll begin to wrap it up. Earlier, we talked about your confusion around the choices that you were making in your 30s and earlier. And it's been some time since you made those choices, and you've done a lot of work on yourself. I know that sometimes when I look back on decisions that I made when I was younger, sometimes I have no idea what I was thinking. I look back and I'm like, oh my gosh, why would I have thought that that was the thing to do? But other times I can look back at the decisions I made and be like, oh, you know what? Even though that was sort of a wild thing to do, I can see why I did that. I can see why I made that choice. When you look back at the younger version of yourself now that you've had this time where you've really reflected on the penance, you've done the work for, looking at your virtues, and now you do ministry and all of these other things. So, Holly, do you, when you look back at these decisions and the younger version of you, can you understand why you made these decisions, or do you still look back and be like, yeah, no, that I shouldn't have done that?
I have many answers today that I did not have then. However, I'm still learning, and it's still a process, right, to examine those types of things. So I would say I'm not fully informed and still seek to better understand myself so I can better understand others and love them and, have mercy for people. As terrible as I did in all these dumb choices, I was doing my best at the time. And I guess my best was not very good. I didn't have a lot of tools in the toolbox. And of
Yeah.
course, I'm responsible for how many tools were there. But I did use all the tools I had put there. And so giving myself a little bit of grace and mercy. And then I think the same when I see other people, especially incarcerated people who have committed terrible crimes, and just being able to be gentle and more humble with people.
Yeah, compassion. What compassion's a wild word because the what it implies that you are sharing in the suffering of the person when you hear their story, right? That's the definition of the word. And it can be really hard to have compassion for people who do things that we don't understand. It's not always easy. But then there is that phrase that's like, they're but for the grace of, and insert your higher power there, but for the grace of the universe, I could do that. I could be that, that could be
There go
happening.
I.
There I go. All right. So you have written a book. The book is called From Surviving to Living. We are recording this interview. The book is not quite out yet. It's going to be out though, definitely by the time the episode comes out in January. And this is the story of from your first day behind bars to the long years of struggle and growth that followed. And you have a special offer for the listeners, which is 50% off. And there's a link in the show notes that the audience can click on if they're curious about the book. And the easiest way for everybody who's watching and listening, you guys, to get the link is to be subscribed to my email community. And then I zap it right into your email box and you can click on it. Holly, that's a generous offer. I want to thank you for sharing it and for sharing your story. Are you ready for the final three questions?
I am.
Let's do it. All
Okay.
right. Do you use an alarm to wake up? And if so, what's the first thing you do when you wake up most mornings?
I do not use an alarm. And I, the first thing that I do is make coffee.
Okay.
And I have cats. You have to feed the cats because if they can even see the bottom of the bowl, you are failing, falling down in the job. So that's how I get my day started, is fresh, coffee and cats and sitting down on the couch and planning my day.
Very nice. Very nice. Do you shop online? And if so, what's the most recent thing that you purchased for yourself?
Oh, I wish I was wearing it. I do shop online, and I just bought a shirt that says all my role models went to prison, and then it lists characters from the Bible, John and Joseph and Peter, and so I don't know, I just thought it was a fun shirt and I bought that online.
That is, I okay. I'm gonna totally gonna look that up. That is an interesting t-shirt. I was recently traveling, and so do you remember that book, the game from the 80s, the Oregon Trail?
Yes.
Okay, so I saw a shirt and had that wagon from the Oregon Trail, and then in print it said something like, "Get in, we're getting dysentery," you know, like. We're gonna go get dysentery, and I think that's only funny if you played that game because it always ended with dying. Like no matter what choices you made, it was like, and now you've died from dysentery. You know. All right. So last question: if you won the Powerball lottery, okay, so like the big lottery that gets to like the hundreds of millions of dollars, right? To this pretend situation, you're the only one that wins. It's imaginary, right? You get all the money. What is the first thing you would purchase for yourself? The only rule about this is that it has to be for you. It can be an experience, it can be a stuff, but what would you buy first, if you won that big prize?
So, of course, after buying this one thing for myself, I will dedicate my attention to finding wise ways to use the rest of it. But I think I would buy a new car. I have never owned a new car all my life. And I would probably buy an expensive fancy one, like a Maybach or something, really.
If you had all those dollars in the
If I
bank,
had all
yeah.
those dollars, yeah.
There you go. That's it, Holly. But thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again. Please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.